since he had approached me about the Rita Hayworth poster like a kid buying his first pack of Trojans, Andy lost his cool. Only this time, he blew it entirely. I saw him later that day, and he looked like a man who had stepped on the business end of a rake and given himself a good one, whap, between the eyes. His hands were trembling, and when I spoke to him, he didn't answer. Before that afternoon was out, he had caught up with Billy Hanlon, who was the head screw, and set up an appointment with Warden Norton for the following day. He told me later that he didn't sleep a wink all that night. He just listened to a cold winter wind howling outside, watched the searchlights go around and around, putting long, moving shadows on the cement walls of the cage he had called home since Harry Truman was president, and tried to think it all out. He said it was as if Tommy had produced a key which fit a cage in the back of his mind, a cage like his own cell. Only instead of holding a man, that cage held a tiger, and that tiger's name was Hope. Williams had produced the key that unlocked the cage, and the tiger was out, willy-nilly, to roam his brain. 4 years before, Tommy Williams had been arrested in Rhode Island, driving a stolen car that was full of stolen merchandise. Tommy turned in his accomplice, the DA played ball, and he got a lighter sentence, 2 to 4 with time served. 11 months after beginning his term, his old cellmate got a ticket out, and Tommy got a new one, a man named Elwood Blatch. Blatch had been busted for burglary with a weapon and was serving 6 to 12. "I've never seen such a high-strung guy," Tommy told me. "A man like that should never want to be a burglar, especially not with a gun. The slightest little noise he'd go 3 feet into the air and come down shooting, more likely than not. One night he almost strangled me because some guy down the hall was whopping on his cell bars with a tin cup. I did 7 months with him until they let me walk free. I got time served and time off, you understand. I can't say we talked because you didn't, you know, exactly hold a conversation with L. Blatch. He held a conversation with you. He talked all the time, never shut up. If you tried to get a word in, he'd shake his fist at you and roll his eyes. It gave me the cold chills whenever he done that. Big, tall guy he was, mostly bald, with these green eyes set way down deep in the sockets. Jeez, I hope I never see him again. It was like a talking jag every night. Where he grew up, the orphanages he'd run away from, the jobs he'd done, the women he'd fucked, the crap games he'd cleaned out. I just let him run on. My face ain't much, but I didn't want it, you know, rearranged for me. According to him, he'd burgled over 200 joints. It was hard for me to believe a guy like him who went off like a firecracker every time someone cut a loud fart, but he swore it was true. Now, listen to me, Red, I know guys sometimes make things up after they know a thing, but even before I knew about this golf pro guy, Quentin, I remember thinking that if L. Blatch ever burgled my house and I found out about it later, I'd have to count myself just about the luckiest motherfucker going still to be alive. Can you imagine him in some lady's bedroom sifting through her jewelry box and she coughs in her sleep or turns over quick? Gives me the cold chills just to think of something like that. I swear on my mother's name it does. He said he'd killed people, too. People that gave him shit. At least that's what he said. And I believed him. He sure looked like a man who could do some killing. He was just so fucking high-strung. Like a pistol with a sawed-off firing pin. I knew a guy who had a Smith & Wesson police special with a sawed-off firing pin. It wasn't no good for nothing, except maybe for something to jaw about. The pull on that gun was so light that it would fire if this guy, Johnny Callahan his name was, if he turned his record player on full volume and put it on top of one of the speakers. That's how L. Blatch was. I can't explain it any better. I just never doubted that he had greased some people. So one night, just for something to say, I go, "Who'd you kill?" Like a joke, you know, so he laughs and says, "There's one guy doing time up Maine for these two people I killed. It was this guy and the wife of the slob is doing the time. I was creeping their place and the guy started to give me some shit." "I can't remember if he ever told me the woman's name or not," Tommy went on. "Maybe he did. But in New England, Dufresne's like Smith or Jones in the rest of the country because there's so many frogs up here. Dufresne, Levesque, Ouellette, Poulin, who can remember frog names? But he told me the guy's name. He said the guy was Glenn Quentin and he was a prick. A big, rich prick, a golf pro. Al said he thought the guy might have cash in the house, maybe as much as $5,000. That was a lot of money back then, he says to me, so I go, when was that? And he goes, after the war, just after the war. So he went in and he did the joint, and they woke up and the guy gave him some trouble. That's what Al said. Maybe the guy just started to snore, and that's what I say. Anyway, Al said Quentin was in the sack with some hot-shot lawyer's wife, and they sent the lawyer up to Shawshank State Prison. Then he laughs this big laugh. Holy Christ, I was never so glad of anything as I was when I got my walking papers from that place. I guess you can see why Andy went a little wonky when Tommy told him that story, and why he wanted to see the warden right away. Elwood Blatch had been serving a 6-12 rap when Tommy knew him 4 years before. By the time Andy heard all of this, in 1963, he might be on the verge of getting out, or already out. So those were the two prongs of the spit Andy was roasting on. The idea that Blatch might still be in, on one hand, and the very real possibility that he might be gone like the wind on the other. There were inconsistencies in Tommy's story, but aren't there always in real life? Blatch told Tommy the man who got sent up was a hot-shot lawyer, and Andy was a banker. But those are two professions that people who aren't very educated could easily get mixed up. And don't forget that 12 years had gone by between the time Blatch was reading the clippings about the trial and the time he told the tale to Tommy Williams. He also told Tommy he got better than $1,000 from a footlocker Quentin had in his closet. But the police said at Andy's trial that there had been no sign of burglary. I have a few ideas about that. First, if you take the cash, and the man it belonged to is dead, how are you going to know anything was stolen, unless someone else can tell you it was there to start with? Second, who's to say Blatch wasn't lying about that part of it? Maybe he didn't want to admit killing two people for nothing. Third, maybe there were signs of burglary and the cops either overlooked them, cops can be pretty dumb, or deliberately covered them up so they wouldn't screw the DA's case. The guy was running for public office, remember, and he needed a conviction to run on. An unsolved burglary murder would have done him no good at all. But of the three, I like the middle one best. I've known a few Elwood Blatches in my time at Shawshank, the trigger pullers with the crazy eyes. Such fellows want you to think they got away with the equivalent of the Hope Diamond on every caper, even if they got caught with a $2 Timex and $9 on the one they're doing time for. And there was one thing in Tommy's story that convinced Andy beyond a shadow of a doubt. Blatch hadn't hit Quentin at random. He had called Quentin a big, rich prick, and he had known Quentin was a golf pro. Well, Andy and his wife had been going out to that country club for drinks and dinner once or twice a week for a couple of years, and Andy had done a considerable amount of drinking there once he found out about his wife's affair. There was a marina with the country club, and for a while in 1947 there had been a part-time grease and gas jockey working there who matched Tommy's description of Elwood Blatch, a big, tall man, mostly bald, with deep-set green eyes, a man who had an unpleasant way of looking at you, as though he was sizing you up. He wasn't there long, Andy said. Either he quit, or Briggs, the fellow in charge of the marina, fired him. But he wasn't a man you forgot. He was too striking for that. So Andy went to see Warden Norton on a rainy, windy day, with big gray clouds scudding across the sky above the gray walls, a day when the last of the snow was starting to melt away and show lifeless patches of last year's grass in the fields beyond the prison. The warden has a good-sized office in the administration wing, and behind the warden's desk there's a door which connects with the assistant warden's office. The assistant warden was out that day, but a trustee was there. He was a half-lame fellow whose real name I have forgotten. All the inmates, me included, called him Chester, after Marshal Dillon's sidekick. Chester was supposed to be watering the plants and waxing the floor. My guess is that the plants went thirsty that day, and the only waxing that was done happened because of Chester's dirty ear polishing the keyhole plate of that connecting door. He heard the warden's main door open and close, and then Norton saying, "Good morning, Dufresne. How can I help you?" "Warden," Andy began, and old Chester told us that he could hardly recognize Andy's voice, it was so changed. "Warden, there's something's happened to me that's so I hardly know where to begin." "Well, why don't you just begin at the beginning?" the warden said, probably in his sweetest let's all turn to the 23rd psalm and read in unison voice. That usually works the best. And so Andy did. He began by refreshing Norton on the details of the crime he had been imprisoned for. Then he told the warden exactly what Tommy Williams had told him. He also gave out Tommy's name, which you may think wasn't so wise in light of later developments, but I'd just ask you what else he could have done if his story was to have any credibility at all. When he had finished, Norton was completely silent for some time. I can just see him, probably tipped back in his office chair under the picture of Governor Reed hanging on the wall, his fingers steepled, his liver lips pursed, his brow wrinkled into ladder rungs halfway to the crown of his head, his 30-year pin gleaming mellowly. "Yes," he said finally, "that's the damnedest story I ever heard. But I'll tell you what surprises me most about it, Dufresne."
"What's that, sir?"
"That you were taken in by it."
"Sir, I don't understand what you mean."
And Chester said that Andy Dufresne, who had faced down Byron Hadley on the plate shop roof 13 years before, was almost floundering for words.
"Well now," Norton said, "it's pretty obvious to me that this young fellow Williams is impressed with you. Quite taken with you, as a matter of fact. He hears your tale of woe, and it's quite natural of him to want to cheer you up, let's say. Quite natural. He's a young man, not terribly bright, not surprising he didn't realize what a state it would put you into. Now, what I suggest is..."
"Don't you think I thought of that?" Andy asked. "But I never told Tommy about the man working down at the marina. I never told anyone that. It never even crossed my mind. But Tommy's description of his cellmate and that man, they're identical."
"Well, now, you may be indulging in a little selective perception there," Norton said with a chuckle. Phrases like that, selective perception, are required learning for people in the penology and corrections business, and they use them all they can.
"That's not it at all, sir."
"That's your slant on it," Norton said. "But mine differs. And let's remember that I have only your word that there was such a man working at the Falmouth Hills Country Club back then."
"No, sir," Andy broke in again.
"No, that isn't true, because..." "Anyway," Norton overrode him, expansive and loud, "let's just look at it from the other end of the telescope, shall we? Suppose, just suppose now, that there really was a fellow named Elwood Blotch."
"Blatch," Andy said tightly.
"Blatch, by all means. And let's say he was Thomas Williams' cellmate in Rhode Island. The chances are excellent that he has been released by now. Excellent. Why, we don't even know how much time he might have done there before he ended up with Williams, do we? Only that he was doing a 6 to 12.
"No, we don't know how much time he'd done. But Tommy said he was a bad actor, a cut-up. I think there's a fair chance that he may still be in. Even if he's been released, the prison will have a record of his last known address, the names of his relatives, and both would almost certainly be dead ends."
Andy was silent for a moment, and then he burst out, "Well, it's a chance, isn't it?"
"Yes, of course it is. So just for the moment, Dufresne, let's assume that Blatch exists, and that he is still safely ensconced in the Rhode Island State Penitentiary. Now, what is he going to say if we bring this kettle of fish to him in a bucket? Is he going to fall down on his knees, roll his eyes, and say, 'I did it, I did it, by all means add a life term onto my charge'?"
"How can you be so obtuse?" Andy said, so low that Chester could barely hear. But he heard the warden just fine.
"What? What did you call me?"
"Obtuse," Andy cried.
"Is it deliberate?"
"Dufresne, you've taken 5 minutes of my time. No, 7, and I have a very busy schedule today. So I believe we'll just declare this little meeting closed, and..."
"The country club will have all the old-time cards. Don't you realize that?" Andy shouted. "They'll have tax forms and W-2s and unemployment compensation forms, all with his name on them. There will be employees there now that were there then, maybe Briggs himself. It's been 15 years, not forever. They'll remember him. They will remember Blatch. If I've got Tommy to testify to what Blatch told him, and Briggs to testify that Blatch was there, actually working at the country club, I can get a new trial. I can..."
"Guard! Guard! Take this man away!"
"What's the matter with you?" Andy said, and Chester told me he was very nearly screaming by then. "It's my life, my chance to get out, don't you see that? And you won't make a single long-distance call to at least verify Tommy's story? Listen, I'll pay for the call. I'll pay for—" And then there was the sound of thrashing as the guards grabbed him and started to drag him out. "Solitary," Warden Norton said dryly. He was probably fingering his 30-year pin as he said it. "Bread and water." And so they dragged Andy away, totally out of control now, still screaming at the warden. Chester said you could hear him even after the door was shut. "It's my life! It's my life! Don't you understand? It's my life!"
20 days on the grain and drain train for Andy, down there in solitary. It was his second jolt in solitary, and his dust-up with Norton was his first real black mark since he had joined our happy little family. I'll tell you a little bit about Shawshank Solitary while we're on the subject. It's something of a throwback to those hardy pioneer days of the early to mid-1700s in Maine. In those days, no one wasted much time with such things as penology and rehabilitation and selective perception. In those days, you were taken care of in terms of absolute black and white. You were either guilty or innocent. If you were guilty, you were either hung or put in jail. And if you were sentenced to jail, you did not go to an institution. No, you dug your own jail with a spade provided by the province of Maine. You dug it as wide and as deep as you could during the period between sunup and sundown. Then they gave you a couple of skins and a bucket, and down you went. Once down, the jailer would bar the top of your hole, throw down some grain or maybe a piece of maggoty meat once or twice a week, and maybe there would be a dipperful of barley soup on Sunday night. You pissed in the bucket, and you held up the same bucket for water when the jailer came round at 6 in the morning. When it rained, you used the bucket to bail out your jail cell. Unless, that is, you wanted to drown like a rat in a rain barrel. No one spent a long time in the hole, as it was called. 30 months was an unusually long term, and so far as I've been able to tell, the longest term ever spent from which an inmate actually emerged alive was served by the so-called Durham Boy, a 14-year-old psychopath who castrated a schoolmate with a piece of rusty metal. He did 7 years, but of course he went in young and strong. You have to remember that for a crime that was more serious than petty theft or blasphemy or forgetting to put a snot rag in your pocket when out of doors on the Sabbath, you were hung. For low crimes, such as those just mentioned, and for others like them, you do your 3 or 6 or 9 months in the hole and come out fish-belly white, cringing from the wide-open spaces, your eyes half-blind, your teeth more than likely rocking and rolling in their sockets from the scurvy, your feet crawling with fungus. Jolly old province of Maine. Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. Shawshank's solitary wing was nowhere as bad as that, I guess. Things come in 3 major degrees in the human experience, I think. There's good, bad, and terrible. And as you go down into progressive darkness towards terrible, it gets harder and harder to make subdivisions. To get to solitary wing, you were led down 23 steps to a basement level where the only sound was the drip of water. The only light was supplied by a series of dangling 60-watt bulbs. The cells were keg-shaped, like those wall safes rich people sometimes hide behind a picture. Like a safe, the round doorways were hinged and solid instead of barred. You got ventilation from above, but no light except from your own 60-watt bulb, which was turned off from a master switch promptly at 8 p.m., an hour before lights out in the rest of the prison. The light bulb wasn't in a wire mesh cage or anything like that. The feeling was that if you wanted to exist down there in the dark, you were welcome to it. Not many did. But after 8, of course, you had no choice. You had a bunk bolted to the wall and a can with no toilet seat. You had 3 ways to spend your time: sitting, shitting, or sleeping. Big choice. 20 days could get to seem like a year. 30 days could seem like 2. And 40 days like 10. Sometimes you could hear rats in the ventilation system.
In a situation like that, subdivisions of terrible tend to get lost. If anything at all can be said in favor of solitary, it's just that you get time to think. Andy had 20 days in which to think while he enjoyed his grain and drain, and when he got out he requested another meeting with the warden. Request denied. Such a meeting, the warden told him, would be counterproductive. That's another one of those phrases you have to master before you can go to work in the prison and corrections field. Patiently, Andy renewed his request, and renewed it, and renewed it. He had changed, had Andy Dufresne. Suddenly, as that spring of 1963 bloomed around us, there were lines in his face and sprigs of gray showing in his hair. He had lost that little trace of a smile that always seemed to linger around his mouth. His eyes stared out into space more often. And you get to know that when a man stares that way, he is counting up the years served, the months, the weeks, the days. He renewed his request and renewed it. He was patient. He had nothing but time. It got to be summer. In Washington, President Kennedy was promising a fresh assault on poverty and on civil rights inequalities, not knowing he had only half a year to live. In Liverpool, a musical group called the Beatles was emerging as a force to be reckoned with in British music, but I guess that no one stateside had yet heard of them. The Boston Red Sox, still 4 years away from what New England folks call the miracle of 67, were languishing in the cellar of the American League. All of those things were going on out in a larger world where people walked free. Norton saw him near the end of June, and this conversation I heard about from Andy himself some 7 years later. "If it's the squeeze, you don't have to worry," Andy told Norton in a low voice. "Do you think I'd talk that up? I'd be cutting my own throat. I'd be just as indictable as..." "That's enough," Norton interrupted. His face was as long and cold as a slate gravestone. He leaned back in his office chair until the back of his head almost touched the sampler, reading, "His judgment cometh in that right early." "But don't you ever mention money to me again," Norton said. "Not in this office, not anywhere. Not unless you want to see that library turned back into a storage room and paint locker again. Do you understand?" "I was trying to set your mind at ease, that's all." "Well, now, when I need a sorry son of a bitch like you to set my mind at ease, I'll retire. I agreed to this appointment because I got tired of being pestered, Dufresne. I wanted to stop. If you want to buy this particular Brooklyn Bridge, that's your affair. Don't make it mine. I could hear crazy stories like yours twice a week if I wanted to lay myself open to them. Every sinner in this place would be using me for a crying towel. I had more respect for you, but this is the end. The end. Have we got an understanding?" "Yes," Andy said. "But I'll be hiring a lawyer, you know." "What in God's name for?" "I think we can put it together," Andy said. "With Tommy Williams and with my testimony and corroborative testimony from records and employees at the country club, I think we can put it together." "Tommy Williams is no longer an inmate of this facility." "What?" "He's been transferred."
"Transferred where?"
"Cashman." At that, Andy fell silent. He was an intelligent man, but it would have taken an extraordinarily stupid man not to smell deal all over that. Cashman was a minimum security prison far up north in Aroostook County. The inmates pick a lot of potatoes, and that's hard work, but they are paid a decent wage for their labor, and they can attend classes at CVI, a pretty decent vocational technical institute, if they so desire. More important to a fellow like Tommy, a fellow with a young wife and a child, Cashman had a furlough program, which meant a chance to live like a normal man, at least on the weekends. A chance to build a model plane with his kid, have sex with his wife, maybe go on a picnic. Norton had almost surely dangled all of that under Tommy's nose, with only one string attached. Not one more word about Elwood Blatch. Not now, not ever. Or you'll end up doing hard time in Thomaston, down there on scenic Route 1, with the real hard guys, and instead of having sex with your wife, you'll be having it with some old bull queer.
"But why?"
Andy said.
"Why would..."
"As a favor to you," Norton said calmly. I checked with Rhode Island. They did have an inmate named Elwood Blatch. He was given what they call a PP, provisional parole, another one of those crazy liberal programs to put criminals out on the streets. He's since disappeared. Andy said, "The warden down there, is he a friend of yours?" Sam Norton gave Andy a smile as cold as a deacon's watch chain. "We are acquainted," he said.
"Why?" Andy repeated. "Can't you tell me why you did it? You knew I wasn't going to talk about anything you might have had going. You knew that, so why?"
"Because people like you make me sick," Norton said deliberately. "I like you right where you are, Mr. Dufresne, and as long as I am warden here at Shawshank, you are going to be right here. You see, you used to think that you were better than anyone else. I have gotten pretty good at seeing that on a man's face. I marked it on yours the first time I walked into the library. It might as well have been written on your forehead in capital letters. That look is gone now, and I like that just fine. It is not just that you are a useful vessel. Never think that. It is simply that men like you need to learn humility. Why, you used to walk around that exercise yard as if it was a living room, and you were at one of these cocktail parties where the hellbound walk around coveting each other's wives and husbands and getting swinishly drunk. But you don't walk around that way anymore, and I'll be watching to see if you should start to walk that way again. Over a period of years, I'll be watching you with great pleasure. Now get the hell out of here."
"Okay. But all the extracurricular activities stop now, Norton. The investment counseling, the scams, the free tax advice, it all stops. Get H&R Block to tell you how to declare your income." Warden Norton's face first went brick red, and then all the color fell out of it. "You're going back into solitary for that. 30 days, bread and water. Another black mark. And while you're in, think about this. If anything that's been going on should stop, the library goes. I will make it my personal business to see that it goes back to what it was before you came here. And I will make your life very hard, very difficult. You'll do the hardest time it's possible to do. You'll lose that one bunk Hilton down in cell block 5 for starters, and you'll lose those rocks on the windowsill, and you'll lose any protection the guards have given you against the sodomites. You will lose everything. Clear?" I guess it was clear enough. Time continued to pass. The oldest trick in the world, and maybe the only one that really is magic. But Andy Dufresne had changed. He had grown harder. That's the only way I can think of to put it. He went on doing Warden Norton's dirty work, and he held on to the library, so outwardly things were about the same. He continued to have his birthday drinks and his year-end holiday drinks. He continued to share out the rest of each bottle. I got him fresh rock-polishing cloths from time to time, and in 1967 I got him a new rock hammer. The one I'd gotten him 19 years ago had, as I told you, plumb worn out. 19 years! When you say it sudden like that, those three syllables sound like the thud and double locking of a tomb door. The rock hammer, which had been a $10 item back then, went for 22 by 67. He and I had a sad little grin over that. Andy continued to shape and polish the rocks he found in the exercise yard, but the yard was smaller by then. Half of what had been there in 1950 had been asphalted over in 1962. Nonetheless, he found enough to keep him occupied, I guess. When he had finished with each rock, he would put it carefully on his window ledge, which faced east. He told me he liked to look at them in the sun, the pieces of the planet he had taken up from the dirt and shaped. Schists, quartzes, granites, funny little mica sculptures that were held together with airplane glue, various sedimentary conglomerates that were polished and cut in such a way that you could see why Andy called them millennium sandwiches, the layers of different material that had built up over a period of decades and centuries. Andy would give his stones and his rock sculptures away from time to time in order to make room for new ones. He gave me the greatest number, I think, counting the stones that looked like matched cufflinks. I had 5. There was one of the mica sculptures I told you about, carefully crafted to look like a man throwing a javelin, and two of the sedimentary conglomerates, all the levels showing in smoothly polished cross-section. I've still got them, and I take them down every so often and think about what a man can do if he has time enough and the will to use it a drop at a time. So, on the outside at least, things were about the same. If Norton had wanted to break Andy as badly as he had said, he would have had to look below the surface to see the change. But if he had seen how different Andy had become, I think Norton would have been well satisfied with the 4 years following his clash with Andy. He had told Andy that Andy walked around the exercise yard as if he were at a cocktail party. That isn't the way I would have put it, but I know what he meant. It goes back to what I said about Andy wearing his freedom like an invisible coat, about how he never really developed a prison mentality. His eyes never got that dull look. He never developed the walk that men get when a day is over and they are going back to their cells for another endless night, that flat-footed, hump-shouldered walk. Andy walked with his shoulders squared, and his step was always light, as if he were heading home to a good home-cooked meal and a good woman, instead of to a tasteless mess of soggy vegetables, lumpy mashed potato, and a slice or two of that fatty, gristly stuff most of the cons called mystery meat. That, and a picture of Raquel Welch on the wall. But for those 4 years, although he never became exactly like the others, he did become silent, introspective, and brooding. Who could blame him? So maybe it was Warden Norton who was pleased, at least for a while. His dark mood broke around the time of the 1967 World Series. That was the dream year, the year the Red Sox won the pennant instead of placing ninth, as the Las Vegas bookies had predicted. When it happened, when they won the American League pennant, a kind of ebullience engulfed the whole prison. There was a goofy sort of feeling that if the dead Sox could come to life, then maybe anybody could do it. I can't explain that feeling now any more than an ex-Beatle maniac could explain that madness, I suppose. But it was real. Every radio in the place was tuned to the games as the Red Sox pounded down the stretch. There was gloom when the Sox dropped a pair in Cleveland near the end, and a nearly riotous joy when Rico Petrocelli put away the pop fly that clinched it. And then there was the gloom that came when Lundberg was beaten in the seventh game of the series to end the dream just short of complete fruition. It probably pleased Norton to no end, the son of a bitch. He liked his prison wearing sackcloth and ashes. But for Andy, there was no tumble back down into gloom. He wasn't much of a baseball fan anyway, and maybe that was why. Nevertheless, he seemed to have caught the current of good feeling, and for him it didn't peter out again after the last game of the series. He had taken that invisible coat out of the closet and put it on again. I remember one bright gold fall day, in very late October, a couple of weeks after the World Series had ended. It must have been a Sunday, because the exercise yard was full of men walking off the week, tossing a frisbee or two, passing around a football, bartering what they had to barter. Others would be at the long table in the visitors' hall, under the watchful eyes of the screws, talking with their relatives, smoking cigarettes, telling sincere lies, receiving their picked-over care packages. Andy was squatting, Indian fashion, against the wall, chunking two small rocks together in his hands, his face turned up into the sunlight. It was surprisingly warm, that sun, for a day so late in the year. "Hello, Red," he called. "Come on and sit a spell." I did. "You want this?" he asked, and handed me one of the two carefully polished Millennium sandwiches I just told you about. "I sure do," I said. "It's very pretty, thank you." He shrugged and changed the subject. "Big anniversary coming up for you next year." I nodded. Next year would make me a 30-year man. 60% of my life spent in Shawshank State Prison. "Think you'll ever get out?" "Sure. When I have a long white beard and just about 3 marbles left rolling around upstairs." He smiled a little and then turned his face up into the sun again, his eyes closed. "Feels good."
I think it always does when you know the damn winter's almost right on top of you. He nodded, and we were silent for a while. When I get out of here, Andy said finally, I'm going where it's warm all the time. He spoke with such calm assurance, you would have thought he had only a month or so left to serve. You know where I'm going, Red?
Nope.
Zihuatanejo, he said, rolling the word softly from his tongue like music. Down in Mexico. It's a little place maybe 20 miles from Playa Azul and Mexico Highway 37. It's 100 miles northwest of Acapulco on the Pacific Ocean. Do you know what the Mexicans say about the Pacific? I told him I didn't. They say it has no memory. And that's where I want to finish out my life, Red. In a warm place that has no memory. He had picked up a handful of pebbles as he spoke. Now he tossed them one by one and watched them bounce and roll across the baseball diamond's dirt infield, which would be under a foot of snow before long. Zihuatanejo. I'm going to have a little hotel down there. 6 cabanas along the beach and 6 more set further back for the highway trade. I'll have a guy who'll take my guests out charter fishing. There'll be a trophy for the guy who catches the biggest marlin of the season, and I'll put his picture up in the lobby. It won't be a family place. It'll be a place for people on their honeymoons, first or second varieties. And where are you going to get the money to buy this fabulous place, I asked. Your stock account? He looked at me and smiled. That's not so far wrong, he said. Sometimes you startle me, Red. What are you talking about? There are really only 2 types of men in the world when it comes to bad trouble, Andy said, cupping a match between his hands and lighting a cigarette. Suppose there was a house full of rare paintings and sculptures and fine old antiques, Red, and suppose the guy who owned the house heard that there was a monster of a hurricane headed right at it. One of those 2 kinds of men just hopes for the best. The hurricane will change course, he says to himself. No right-thinking hurricane would ever dare wipe out all these Rembrandts, my 2 Degas horses, my Grant Woods, and my Bentons. Furthermore, God wouldn't allow it. And if worse comes to worst, they're insured. That's one sort of man. The other sort just assumes that hurricane is going to tear right through the middle of his house. If the Weather Bureau says the hurricane just changed course, this guy assumes it'll change back in order to put his house on ground zero again. This second type of guy knows there's no harm in hoping for the best, as long as you're prepared for the worst. I lit a cigarette of my own. Are you saying you prepared for the eventuality? Yes, I prepared for the hurricane. I knew how bad it looked. I didn't have much time, but in the time I had, I operated. I had a friend, just about the only person who stood by me, who worked for an investment company in Portland. He died about 6 years ago. Sorry. Yeah. Andy tossed his butt away. Linda and I had about $14,000. Not a big bundle, but, well, we were young. We had our whole lives ahead of us. He grimaced a little, then laughed. When the shit hit the fan, I started lugging my Rembrandts out of the path of the hurricane. I sold my stocks and paid the capital gains tax just like a good little boy, declared everything, didn't cut any corners. Didn't they freeze your estate? I was charged with murder, Red, not dead. You can't freeze the assets of an innocent man, thank God. And it was a while before they even got brave enough to charge me with the crime. Jim, my friend, and I, we had some time. I got hit pretty good, just dumping everything like that, got my nose skinned. But at the time, I had worse things to worry about than a small skinning on the stock market. Yeah, I'd say you did. But when I came to Shawshank, it was all safe. It's still safe. Outside these walls, Red, there's a man that no living soul has ever seen face to face. He has a Social Security card and a Maine driver's license. He's got a birth certificate, name of Peter Stevens. Nice, anonymous name, huh? Who is he? I asked. I thought I knew what he was going to say, but I couldn't believe it. Me. You're not going to tell me that you had time to set up a false identity while the bulls were sweating you, I said.
Or that you finished a job while you were on trial for... No, I'm not going to tell you that. My friend Jim was the one who set up the false identity. He started after my appeal was turned down, and the major pieces of identification were in his hands by the spring of 1950. He must have been a pretty close friend, I said. I was not sure how much of this I believed. A little, a lot, or none. But the day was warm and the sun was out, and it was one hell of a good story. All of that's 100% illegal, setting up a false ID like that. He was a close friend, Andy said. We were in the war together. France, Germany, the occupation. He was a good friend. He knew it was illegal, but he also knew that setting up a false identity in this country is very easy and very safe. He took my money with all the taxes on it paid so the IRS wouldn't get too interested, and invested it for Peter Stevens. He did that in 1950 and 1951. Today it amounts to $370,000 plus change. I guess my jaw made a thump when it dropped against my chest because he smiled. Think of all the things people wish they'd invested in since 1950 or so, and two or three of them will be things Peter Stevens was into. If I hadn't ended up in here, I'd probably be worth $7 or $8 million by now. I'd have a Rolls and probably an ulcer as big as a portable radio. His hands went to the dirt and began sifting out more pebbles. They moved gracefully, restlessly. It was hoping for the best and expecting the worst. Nothing but that. The false name was just to keep what little capital I had untainted. It was lugging the paintings out of the path of the hurricane. But I had no idea that the hurricane... that it could go on as long as it has. I didn't say anything for a while. I guess I was trying to absorb the idea that this small, spare man in prison gray next to me could be worth more money than Warden Norton would make in the rest of his miserable life, even with the scams thrown in. "When you said you could get a lawyer, you sure weren't kidding," I said at last. "For that kind of dough, you could have hired Clarence Darrow, or whoever's passing for him these days. Why didn't you, Andy? Christ! You could have been out of here like a rocket." He smiled. It was the same smile that had been on his face when he told me he and his wife had had their whole lives ahead of them. "No," he said. "A good lawyer would have sprung the Williams kid from Cashman whether he wanted to go or not," I said. I was getting carried away now. "You could have gotten your new trial, hired private detectives to look for that guy Blatch, and blown Norton out of the water to boot. Why not, Andy?" "Because I outsmarted myself. If I ever try to put my hands on Peter Stevens' money from inside here, I'll lose every cent of it. My friend Jim could have arranged it, but Jim's dead. You see the problem?" I saw it. For all the good that money could do Andy, it might as well have really belonged to another person. In a way it did. And if the stuff it was invested in suddenly turned bad, all Andy could do would be to watch the plunge, to trace it day after day on the stocks and bonds page of the Press Herald. It's a tough life if you don't weaken, I guess. "I'll tell you how it is, Red. There's a big hayfield in the town of Buxton. You know where Buxton is at, don't you?" I said I did. "It lies right next door to Scarborough." "That's right. And at the north end of this particular hayfield, there's a rock wall right out of a Robert Frost poem. And somewhere along the base of that wall is a rock that has no business in a main hayfield. It's a piece of volcanic glass, and until 1947 it was a paperweight on my office desk. My friend Jim put it in that wall. There's a key underneath it. The key opens a safe deposit box in the Portland branch of the Casco Bank." "I guess you're in a peck of trouble," I said. "When your friend Jim died, the IRS must have opened all of his safe deposit boxes, along with the executor of his will, of course." Andy smiled and tapped the side of my head. "Not bad. There's more up there than marshmallows, I guess. But we took care of the possibility that Jim might die while I was in the slam. The box is in the Peter Stevens name, and once a year the firm of lawyers that served as Jim's executors sends a check to the Casco to cover the rental of the Stevens box.
Peter Stevens is inside that box, just waiting to get out. His birth certificate, his social security card, and his driver's license. The license is 6 years out of date because Jim died 6 years ago, true, but it's still perfectly renewable for a $5 fee. His stock certificates are there, the tax-free municipals, and about 18 bearer bonds in the amount of $10,000 each. I whistled. Peter Stevens is locked in a safe deposit box at the Casco Bank in Portland, and Andy Dufresne is locked in a safe deposit box at Shawshank, he said, tit for tat. And the key that unlocks the box and the money and the new life is under a hunk of black glass in a Buxton hayfield. Told you this much, or I'll tell you something else, Red. For the last 20 years, give or take, I have been watching the papers with a more than usual interest for news of any construction project in Buxton. I keep thinking that someday soon I'm going to read that they're putting a highway through there, or erecting a new community hospital, or building a shopping center, burying my new life under 10 feet of concrete, or spitting it into a swamp somewhere with a big load of fill. I blurted, Jesus Christ, Andy, if all of this is true, how do you keep from going crazy? He smiled. So far, all quiet on the Western Front. But it could be years. It will be. But maybe not as many as the state and Warden Norton think it's going to be. I just can't afford to wait that long. I keep thinking about Zihuatanejo and that small hotel. That's all I want from my life now, Red, and I don't think that's too much to want. I didn't kill Glenn Quentin, and I didn't kill my wife. And that hotel, it's not too much to want. To swim, and get a tan, and sleep in a room with open windows and space, that's not too much to want. He slung the stones away. You know, Red, he said in an offhand voice, a place like that, I'd have to have a man who knows how to get things. I thought about it for a long time, and the biggest drawback in my mind wasn't even that we were talking pipe dreams in a shitty little prison exercise yard with armed guards looking down at us from their sentry posts. I couldn't do it, I said. I couldn't get along on the outside. I'm what they call an institutional man now. In here, I'm the man who can get it for you, yeah, but out there, anyone can get it for you. Out there, if you want posters or rock hammers or one particular record or a boat-in-a-bottle model kit, you can use the fucking Yellow Pages. In here, I'm the fucking Yellow Pages. I wouldn't know how to begin or where. You underestimate yourself, he said. You're a self-educated man, a self-made man, a rather remarkable man, I think. Hell, I don't even have a high school diploma. I know that, he said, but it isn't just a piece of paper that makes a man, and it isn't just prison that breaks one either. I couldn't hack it outside, Andy. I know that. He got up. You think it over, he said casually, just as the inside whistle blew, and he strolled off, as if he were a free man who had just made another free man a proposition. And for a while, just that was enough to make me feel free. Andy could do that. He could make me forget for a time that we were both lifers at the mercy of a hard-ass parole board and a psalm-singing warden who liked Andy Dufresne right where he was. After all, Andy was a lapdog who could do tax returns. What a wonderful animal. But by that night in my cell, I felt like a prisoner again. The whole idea seemed absurd, and that mental image of blue water and white beaches seemed more cruel than foolish. It dragged at my brain like a fishhook. I just couldn't wear that invisible coat the way Andy did. I fell asleep that night and dreamed of a great glassy black stone in the middle of a hayfield, a stone shaped like a giant blacksmith's anvil. I was trying to rock the stone up so I could get the key that was underneath. It wouldn't budge, it was just too damned big. And in the background, but getting closer, I could hear the baying of bloodhounds. Which leads us, I guess, to the subject of jailbreaks. Sure, they happen from time to time in our happy little family. You don't go over the wall, though, not at Shawshank, not if you're smart. The searchlight beams go all night, probing long white fingers across the open fields that surround the prison on three sides and the stinking marshland on the fourth. Cons do go over the wall from time to time, and the searchlights almost always catch them. If not, they get picked up trying to thumb a ride on Highway 6 or Highway 99. If they try to cut across country, some farmer sees them and just phones the location into the prison. Cons who go over the wall are stupid cons. Shawshank is no Cannon City, but in a rural area, a man humping his ass across country in a gray pajama suit sticks out like a cockroach on a wedding cake. Over the years, the guys who have done the best, maybe oddly, maybe not so oddly, are the guys who did it on the spur of the moment. Some of them have gone out in the middle of a cart full of sheets. A convict sandwich on white, you could say. There was a lot of that when I first came in here, but over the years they have more or less closed that loophole. Warden Norton's famous Inside Out program produced its share of escapees, too. They were the guys who decided they liked what lay to the right of the hyphen better than what lay to the left. And again, in most cases, it was a very casual kind of thing. Drop your blueberry rake and stroll into the bushes while one of the screws is having a glass of water at the truck, or when a couple of them get too involved in arguing over yards passing or rushing on the old Boston Patriots. In 1969, the Inside Outers were picking potatoes in Sabattis. It was the 3rd of November, and the work was almost done. There was a guard named Henry Pugh, and he is no longer a member of our happy little family, believe me, sitting on the back bumper of one of the potato trucks and having his lunch with his carbine across his knees, when a beautiful, or so it was told to me, but sometimes these things get exaggerated, 10-point buck strolled out of the cold early afternoon mist. Pugh went after it with visions of just how that trophy would look mounted in his rec room, and while he was doing it, three of his charges just walked away. Two were recaptured in a Lisbon Falls pinball parlor. The third has not been found to this day. I suppose the most famous case of all was that of Sid Nadeau. This goes back to 1958, and I guess it will never be topped. Sid was out lining the ball field for a Saturday intramural baseball game when the 3 o'clock inside whistle blew, signaling the shift change for the guards. The parking lot is just beyond the exercise yard, on the other side of the electrically operated main gate. At 3, the gate opens, and the guards coming on duty and those going off mingle. There's a lot of back-slapping and bully-ragging, comparison of league bowling scores, and the usual number of tired old ethnic jokes. Sid just trundled his lining machine right out through the gate, leaving a 3-inch baseline all the way from home plate in the exercise yard to the ditch on the far side of Route 6, where they found the machine overturned in a pile of lime. Don't ask me how he did it. He was dressed in his prison uniform, he stood 6'2", and he was billowing clouds of lime dust behind him. All I can figure is that, it being Friday afternoon and all, the guards going off were so happy to be going off, and the guards coming in were so down-hearted to be coming in, that the members of the former group never got their heads out of the clouds, and those in the latter never got their noses off their shoe tops. And old Sid Nadeau just sort of slipped out between the two. So far as I know, Sid is still at large. Over the years, Andy Dufresne and I had a good many laughs over Sid Nadeau's great escape, and when we heard about that airline hijacking for ransom, the one where the guy parachuted from the back door of the airplane, Andy swore up and down that D.B. Cooper's real name was Sid Nadeau. And he probably had a pocket full of baseline lime in his pocket for good luck, Andy said, that lucky son of a bitch. But you should understand that a case like Sid Nadeau, or the fellow who got clean away from the Sabattis potato field crew, guys like that are winning the prison version of the Irish sweepstakes. Purely a case of 6 different kinds of luck somehow gelling together all at the same moment. A stiff like Andy could wait 90 years and not get a similar break. Maybe you remember, a ways back I mentioned a guy named Henley Backus, the washroom foreman in the laundry. He came to Shawshank in 1922 and died in the prison infirmary 31 years later. Escapes and escape attempts were a hobby of his, maybe because he never quite dared to take the plunge himself. He could tell you 100 different schemes, all of them crackpot, and all of them had been tried in the shank at one time or another. My favorite was the tale of Beaver Morrison, a B&E convict who tried to build a glider from scratch in the plate factory basement. The plans he was working from were in a circa 1900 book called The Modern Boy's Guide to Fun and Adventure. Beaver got it built without being discovered, or so the story goes, only to discover there was no door from the basement big enough to get the damn thing out. When Henley told that story, you could bust a gut laughing, and he knew a dozen, no, two dozen, almost as funny. When it came to detailing Shawshank bust-outs, Henley had it down, chapter and verse. He told me once that during his time there had been better than 400 escape attempts that he knew of. Really think about that for a moment before you just nod your head and pass on. 400 escape attempts. That comes out to 12.9 escape attempts for every year Henley Backus was in Shawshank and keeping track of them. The Escape Attempt of the Month Club. Of course, most of them were pretty slipshod affairs, the sort of thing that ends up with a guard grabbing some poor sidling slob's arm and growling, "Where do you think you're going, you happy asshole?" Henley said he'd class maybe 60 of them as more serious attempts, and he included the prison break of 1937, the year before I arrived at the shank. The new administration wing was under construction then, and 14 cons got out using construction equipment in a poorly locked shed. The whole of southern Maine got into a panic over those 14 hardened criminals, most of whom were scared to death and had no more idea of where they should go than a jackrabbit does when its headlight pinned to the highway with a big truck bearing down on it. Not one of those 14 got away. Two of them were shot dead by civilians, not police officers or prison personnel, but none got away. How many had gotten away between 1938, when I came here, and that day in October when Andy first mentioned Zihuatanejo to me? Putting my information and Henley's together, I'd say 10. 10 that got away clean. And although it isn't the kind of thing you can know for sure, I'd guess that at least half of those 10 are doing time in other institutions of lower learning, like the shank, because you do get institutionalized. When you take away a man's freedom and teach him to live in a cell, he seems to lose his ability to think in dimensions. He's like that jackrabbit I mentioned, frozen in the oncoming lights of the truck that is bound to kill it. More often than not, a con who's just out will pull some dumb job that hasn't a chance in hell of succeeding. And why? Because it'll get him back inside, back where he understands how things work. Andy wasn't that way, but I was. The idea of seeing the Pacific sounded good, but I was afraid that actually being there would scare me to death. The bigness of it. Anyhow, the day of that conversation about Mexico and about Mr. Peter Stevens, that was the day I began to believe that Andy had some idea of doing a disappearing act. I hoped to God he would be careful if he did, and still I wouldn't have bet money on his chances of succeeding. Warden Norton, you see, was watching Andy with a special close eye. Andy wasn't just another deadhead with a number to Norton. They had a working relationship, you might say. Also, Andy had brains, and he had heart. Norton was determined to use the one and crush the other. As there are honest politicians on the outside, ones who stay bought, there are honest prison guards. And if you're a good judge of character, and if you have some loot to spread around, I suppose it's possible that you could buy enough look the other way to make a break. I'm not the man to tell you such a thing has never been done, but Andy Dufresne wasn't the man who could do it, because, as I've said, Norton was watching. Andy knew it, and the screws knew it, too. Nobody was going to nominate Andy for the Inside Out program, not as long as Warden Norton was evaluating the nominations, and Andy was not the kind of man to try a casual Sid Nadeau type of escape. If I had been him, the thought of that key would have tormented me endlessly. I would have been lucky to get 2 hours' worth of honest shut-eye a night. Buxton was less than 30 miles from Shawshank. So near and yet so far.